from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the GoodAtheist.net podcast. My name is Jacob Forte.
Oh, and I'm Carissa Hendricks.
Why do you always seem surprised
every time
I say my name? You're like, oh, am I supposed to say something? This is like
listening.
The fourth show you're doing, and you're still surprised.
I'm used to listening to the podcast. As soon as you say that, I'm like, oh, I get to listen now. And then I have to respond.
This is what's so hilarious, folks. Every time she does the show, halfway through, she gets into listener mode. I literally have to poke her and be like, you have to talk now.
Oh, you have to talk now.
Do you not sometimes talk when you're listening to the show and you're like, oh, Jacob, you should say this and that? You don't do that kind of thing?
I listen to your show very passively. I just kind of...
Yeah, that's right. You said something along the lines is you only really listen when I'm in rant mode.
When you repeat things. Well, no, it's not that I listen deliberately when you start to get into rant mode. Other than that, I just kind of passively absorb the information.
Okay. Passive absorption. Got it. Gotcha.
Sorry.
I wonder if it's like that with other people. Hopefully...
I try really hard not to say, oh, okay.
Yeah, exactly. You know what? Yeah, exactly. That's the whole thing. At the end, I don't want you to be surprised again that I say goodbye and my name, just so we're clear on this.
All right?
Try to be professional. I'm so mean.
Trying
okay.
To be professional. It's like 11 o'clock at night, and we're recording.
You know what? I'm used to doing late shows. It happens. You know, once in a while, you have plans, or sometimes you're feeling kind of dry. It's not a 9-to-5 process recording podcasts. You know, sometimes I have to delay it with a day because I feel like shit, or I have nothing interesting to say. Who wants to have a podcast when I have nothing interesting to say? You might as well just listen to static noise for a while. I have nothing of interest to say. Blah, 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 blah.
You'd be like all those other atheist podcasts.
Oh, snazap.
I
don't like to talk shit about the other ones because who knows? It might bite me in the ass later. So I'm going to let you talk shit about other atheist podcasts. And meanwhile, I'm going to be the nice guy that says I don't really listen to them because... As I've said before, I am not a podcaster. Mm. I do not listen to podcasts. I generally find podcasts to be kind of boring. I will admit this. It's a little dull.
I'm a podcast junkie.
A lot of fans of the show are admittedly podcast junkies, too.
I don't have a television, though.
I don't have a TV. I'm usually busy checking things out to put on the site. I don't got time to be dicking around, listen to other podcasts.
You watch a shit ton of movies. That is your poison.
Yeah, but I watch movies at like midnight when I'm trying to calm down from
That's
a night.
That's why I listen to podcasts.
Midnight podcasts?
Totally.
Man.
Like when I'm doing web design before bed or something.
You work till midnight? You're a crazy psycho. I'm like, at midnight, it is my cutoff time, everybody.
How often have you logged onto Skype and you're like, it's 3 a.m., what are you doing? I'm working.
That's just because you make me talk to you till 3 o'clock in the morning.
I'm just up. That's just when I'm up. I'm not staying up for you. I'm just up anyway.
Well, it's 3 o'clock in the morning in my time, but it's only 1 o'clock in the morning in your time. That's a real problem. Okay, you know what? Let's stop venting our own personal lives on the radio show.
We've said nothing of interest.
We've said absolutely nothing of interest. Today on the show, we're going to be talking about two subjects. The first one is the cheerful subject of death that we're going to be talking about. Also, evolutionary psychology. Totally not related. The reason I want to talk about death, actually, is I received an email from a brand new patron called Matt, and he messaged me, and I thought he wrote specifically asking me, because he was turning 50, and as most of you know, because I kept mentioning it like 20,000 times, I turned 30 February 28th and also of many of you, many of you probably remember, I was not too happy about this. Because now I'm no longer in my 20s, and even just saying that feels weird.
You know what? I'm jealous. I'm actually jealous of you being in your 30s.
Why are you jealous? That's crazy.
Because as soon as you turn 30, you get this new credibility indicator. So when you try and
do
things...
You read too much Tim Ferriss. That's your problem.
I love him so... No. It's true, though. I mean, I tried to apply to do that TED Talk thing, and I have lots of credentials, and they were like, no, you're a little girl. We don't want to listen to
what
little girls have to say.
And you're tiny.
And your voice
so
is terrible.
Tiny.
And
someone with that voice is a terrible thing. God damn it. Everybody says that it's not. You shut your mouth. I'm sick and tired of you talking about, my voice voice is terrible. Shut up. Your voice is not terrible.
You know what? I think everybody hates their own voice, though. I think that's normal.
I love my own voice.
It's because you're a narcissist.
I am.
Such a narcissist.
Shut up. You're a narcissist, too.
I know.
Anyways,
I just hide it better.
He sends me an email, and he says, well, I was thinking a lot about the fact that you're turning 30, and he was turning 50 himself, and it got him thinking. And basically, here's the part of the email I'm going to write, because this is the most significant part. On birthdays, I also just passed a milestone, the big 50, a few days before yours, and it got me thinking. I found myself really hating the idea of having such a major birthday and went out of my way to avoid being reminded of it. No party, presents, cards, cake of any, or any of the usual trappings. My wife and kids think I'm nuts. It struck me that the reason I felt this way was because I'm an atheist. The fact that I know that life has a finite length and that there's absolutely nothing afterwards means I find being reminded that I'm on a downward slope, frankly, a bit depressing. So he wanted to ask if I had done other shows dealing with death. And I kind of went back to listen. Honestly, I have about of a memory of two shows. Two shows is what I remember. So this is probably the only reason why the podcast can still be entertaining, because I probably repeat myself like 20 times, but I don't even remember what I said. So as far as I'm concerned, I do not remember a show where I did or talked about death. But I thought, man, what a great opportunity. What a great segue. And he's a new patron, so technically he's like my boss now. Every patron who's asking for stuff, I'm surprised you guys don't ask for things more often, because what am I supposed to say? No, fuck you, I don't want your money. Of course I want your money. I want more bosses, is what I want. And besides,
I'm a boss. I'm a patron.
That is true. You
can
are.
Can I ask for shit?
You already do. You ask for lots of things. So you've reached your limit.
Ouch.
You've reached your limit. And you only sent $20, so you reach your limit pretty fast.
Man, ouch.
If you want to send $60, yeah, then you'll have me for, you know, like, you'll have me, I'll be your slave for a couple days for $60.
That's good to know. That's good to know.
Anyways, so I thought it was a really kind of a good topic or a show idea. And I wanted to kind of put in my two cents about this, because as some of you may have heard, a little while ago, I was having perpetual panic attacks, and I did not know that these things were panic attacks. Turns out, I was actually really contemplating a lot about death, and maybe doing it way too much, and it kind of put me in one of those weird spirally modes whenever I was smoking reefer. Anyways, and I think it wasn't that much of a coincidence that this was happening close to when my birthday was coming up, you know. And for me, it's always like I think about my birthday months before it happens, because it's always been a big deal. I love birthdays, you know. It's like my day. It is my fucking day. And besides, there's like no holidays between Christmas and Easter, and I figured February 28th, Jacob Day. You know, if I ever become famous or powerful, people, February 28th is gonna be a holiday. My birthday holiday. Anyways, enough of that egotism. So his question about whether or not I think a lot about death, the answer is, oh my goodness, do I think a lot about death? It's crazy. And I've been talking to a lot of other atheists as well, like other fans of the podcast that sometimes talk to me, and I'll ask them, I'll talk about it, like, how often do you think of death? And they're like, all the fucking time. All the fucking time. And they're like, I even had one guy who himself, he was starting to have paranoid attacks when he was smoking, specifically because, you know, he was just thinking about death a lot. So one of the things that I kind of realized with all these kinds of, I suppose, intense thoughts about death was that, you know, atheism, because it's not a belief system, it's rather just a rejection of, you know, faith-based ideologies.
Of
the supernatural. When it comes to death, it's one of the great issues that we really have to try to confront and deal with. Think about how many people on this planet don't deal with it. You said yourself, when you were religious and you became an atheist, what is the first thing you had to do?
It wasn't my own mortality. It was all about other people's death.
Right. Well,
that
I mean, it was still dealing with death immediately, because they had already died. So I had to register in your mind. You're like, you will never see this fucking person again.
Oh, it was such a shitty month.
The month of death.
You know what, though? This has made me think a little bit. If I can think back, my brother and I used to have these, like, sleepovers where he'd crash in my room, I'd crash in his room. And we just, like, talk late into the night. And I remember being...
That sounds so sweet.
It's cute. I remember being 8 or 9 and having my brother go, what if there is no God and, you know, you die and there's nothing? And just having, like, a little nightmare.
Like a kind of a freak out.
I had a little girl freakout. And I just think that since then I've kind of ignored it, because you know I had that time where there was a chance I was going to die, and I just kind of just didn't think about it. I just don't think about it. I'm one of the atheists that kind of go, I don't think thinking about it makes it easier.
Well, you know what? I think the funny thing, think about the myth of Prometheus in Greek mythology. The gift that Prometheus gave human beings, it is apparently before Prometheus was around, human beings knew when they were going to die. And his gift, although part of his gift that he gave us was knowledge, the one bit of knowledge that he took away from us was awareness of when we were going to die. And I think that kind of is a bit of a allegory to religion in general. Like, I've been really thinking, if I had to pinpoint, put my finger on a main reason why religion exists, let me tell you something. We have a really hard time dealing with death. Are there any other animals out there that you are aware of that know that they're going to die? I mean, they may watch other animals perish. And you know, I know for a fact that wolves will mourn the loss of loved ones, of their kin. So they're obviously aware that people disappear or their other kin will disappear. But do they know themselves that this is something that's going to happen to them inevitably? Mm-hmm. And I think that to some degree, being an adult, like the first thing that comes to mind is just really this awareness that, oh my God, I'm going to fucking die. And everybody has that. And depending on how you deal with it, I mean, I know that the majority of people that deal with it two ways. Number one, they never think about it.
Mm-hmm. That's me.
Because it's not even something that's close by. At least it doesn't seem that way until something fucking tragic happens. Then you're like, oh my God, I'm going to die too. Especially when it's one of those freak things where, you know, a person just dies of something that doesn't even make sense in your mind. You're like, how could this person die of that? Like if they died eating a bunch of marshmallows and choked to death on it, you were like, oh my God, I could die choking a marshmallow.
Or like my young friend who died last month from a random brain aneurysm.
She was how old? 32, I think you were telling me?
Yeah, she was young.
Yeah, so, I mean...
And they say that she was, like, brain dead before she hit the ground or something like that. And
it was
like,
almost instant,
it could
instant,
be so
yeah.
quick. That's You're just the, yeah. dead. How scary is that? See, that's why I don't like to think about this shit. It's not helpful.
Well, we still have to. We're still going to think about it. It is inevitable. I mean, it's just going to come in your mind once in a while. Who knows when? I mean, you could be really sick one day. Come down with pneumonia and then maybe... or get a scare somehow by being in a car accident, or who knows? There's plenty of ways that you're just going to be reminded of that, because for the most part, you don't think about it. Mm-hmm. Unless, you know, there's really something tragic that happens. But I do find myself thinking about death a lot. Sometimes I think about it in the perspective of what is the world going to be like, or what are the people around me that I love and that love me, how are they going to react? Because I'm not around to... comfort them. I'm not around. I'm gone. I'm gone forever. And the concept of being gone forever is a really very strange thing to wrap your head around. It's very frightening. Mm. So I can see how, given the option of looking at death either as I'm going to fucking croak and it's going to be all over. I'm going to experience absolutely nothing. It's going to be like a brief flash of poof and you're gone. Or the people are like, I'm going to go up to Magical Playland where I'm going to meet everyone that's ever died and I've ever loved. And I'm going to be in a perpetual state of orgasm. Gee, I wonder what people are going to pick. And especially if everybody around you is telling you, oh, no, that whole heaven thing is totally fucking real. Totally real. You know how I know? This guy told me, and he was wearing a dress and a crazy hat that looks like one of those McDonald's French fry things. He told me that I was going to go to heaven, and I have every reason to believe him because he is older than me, and he is very, very wise, and sometimes he touches me. Sometimes Ooh. He does touch me.
Oh my goodness, this spiraling conversation. All
right. Well, I'm mean. What can I say? Part of the reason people listen to me is because I'm a cruel son of a bitch.
I want desperately to say it's Dawkins. I don't think, you know, I hope somebody will correct me on whose quote this is, but just the sentence of, when I die, it will be as it was before I was born. And I
tell you who that was, Ryan Harkness. He's been telling me this for years.
I was in a book somewhere. And I find that super comforting. Isn't that so comforting just to think, like, it's, you know, I'm not a terrified of the time that existed before I was alive.
If you really felt that was comforting, then you would allow me to talk about death more often. But you don't. You fucking put a cap on that shit. It's comforting to you for like 15 seconds. And
yeah,
then you realize, hey,
fine.
I didn't get to experience anything when I wasn't born. It's bullshit. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm experience I'm an experienced junkie to some degree. It doesn't have to be a grandiose experience. I just don't want it to stop. I don't want new information or new experiences or new meeting with people. I don't want that to stop. And that's what death is. It is, everything stops for you. It's just like, it doesn't matter. The world didn't matter. The universe existing didn't matter. It's gone. It is fucking gone. And it is hard to sort of like fathom and accept that. But I think to some degree that the cure against this, and I've been trying really hard to stop thinking about it because it is only 30. I got to stop freaking out. And like you said, there are some advantages to it. Now I'm all of a sudden a lot more credible. It feels less weird having people that are older than me listen to the show, especially people that have like some pretty impressive fucking credentials, you know, listening to me. There's no reason why you should be listening to me. It's just because there's nobody who's doing it that's super educated that's doing it well. that's the only reason you're listening to me. But as soon as somebody does, you're going to betray me, you sons of bitches.
Yeah, as soon as it's like a PZ Myers who's focusing on atheist stuff, you're screwed.
I'm totally screwed.
You can just hide under your couch.
I'm going to try to do something different. I'm going to sell matches like the little matchstick girl. It really worked out for her in the end. Frozen to death. Well, you know what? Here's the thing. If you're a matchstick girl, don't live somewhere where it's wintertime. That's my only piece of advice. Don't live somewhere where it's perpetually summer or at least warm.
Stupid her for being born there. Stupid, stupid girl.
Definitely stupid. Well, okay. What do you think is sort of the solution? How can you stop thinking about death? Because I feel that to some degree, with some people, me myself, at least for those months where I was having just a constant freak out about the fact that I was going to die, it wasn't exactly allowing me to live as good a quality of life as I think I should. It was just something where all of a sudden you're always second guessing everything that you're doing because you're almost obsessed about living life to its maximum. And all of a sudden, you're just not living life anymore. You're like, well, I don't want to do this. It might be dangerous. Or, oh my goodness, I don't want to take risks.
God, if I got that way, I would have to find a new fucking career. Like,
yeah, you eat fire for a living.
I don't know. I think I really can't think about death on a daily basis because I would quit my job and do something that's much safer. I do not have the safest career. But I don't know. I think it's okay to think about it. It's okay to face your own mortality. It's okay to intellectualize. But the reality is when you're dead, it's over. It's gone. So what?
Well,
it's just done.
Maybe my advice to Matt is basically this, that if you're given the two options, the first option is to try not to make a big deal out of your birthdays because you feel as though it is really reminding you of the fact that you are one day going to die. I think that if you're going to be reminded of it, you might as well have some fucking fun while it's happening. And how many days can you just celebrate just you in a selfish, selfish way? That's what I like about birthdays. You can be selfish.
And people want to. People, you know, it is part of the human desire that your friends want to please you. Give them an opportunity for your friends and family to take care of you for a fucking day. I'm sure they want to.
I think you're going to, at the end of the day, you're going to appreciate your life a lot more. That, you know, if you are 50, I don't know how many more fucking years you got left. Heart attacks can come and go. At least, hopefully, you're staying healthy. If you're listening to the show, constantly sitting on your ass, not doing any exercises because your job, odds are maybe you're not.
You know what? Okay, I'm going to say something controversial. I have a
Please
secret
do.
Thing that I think.
Oh,
I
boy.
Think, and you might be offended.
Go ahead.
I think that people who start to obsess about death,
yeah,
it's because they're not doing anything. I think when you're busy having adventures and having fun and living your life and really being, I mean, I'm super naive. I'm only in my 20s. Maybe I'm a fucking retard. But I have read a lot of self-help books, and a lot of them come down to this whole idea that the human mind needs to be active. You need to feel like you're doing things. You need to create moments. I mean, you know, there's graduation, then there's you get married, and then there's you have kids, and you have to make sure that you create and even fake some more milestones in your life, because that's how the human brain deals with the passing of time. And if you feel like you've been stagnant too long, then you have already on some level tasted your own death. You've tasted nothingness.
I think you're half right. I think the other portion of it is that sometimes you can have so much to lose when things are really fucking good, right? Or you're living just a great life. You do kind of fear losing it. Imagine you had a beautiful car, like just a fucking, like in the car in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. All right. You would fear getting it scratched. You would fear it falling apart. You would just never take it out of the garage. How many miles was there on it in the movie? 116 miles. A fucking pathetic amount for such a beautiful car. The things need to be driven, right? But I think that for me, it's not so much that I don't do anything, which is partially true, everybody, but that's only because of my current financial situation. Remember, there are bonus podcasts available for people who want to improve that situation. More on that later. But I think it's just because there is a part of me that the more life gets interesting and exciting and that there's potential to really live a great life, the more I'm fucking nervous about losing it all.
Yeah,
because
is that because you're living in the future and you're afraid that you're going to lose the
possibility? I always live in the future.
You know, but
cannot live in the present.
But that goes back to what I was saying. That's what I was saying. I mean, if you're living in the future and you have this fear of losing this potential good life that you've been working
No, but
this
is just me. This is just me. Like, in the case of someone who has already, say, done quite a bit and has a life that's almost envious, or, you know, that they're happy themselves, it's just that while you have it, there's a part of you that may have a bit of a paranoia. Say, one day I will lose this. One day it will be gone, and I will be gone, and I won't even be around to experience it.
But I really do think that you know, if you do have a lot of stuff, and you're like, oh, I'm so scared I'm going to lose this. It's not, I'm scared I'm going to lose what I have right now. I'm scared. It's more of a, I'm scared I'm going to lose what I'm going to attain in the future, because it's those people who are constantly living into their future selves, whereas they're not really being in the moment. Because if you're in the moment and you're having adventures and you're doing crazy shit, I don't know how many times that you've been on like a tour or doing something cool or fun. I don't think about death once when I'm doing that.
That's because
stuff.
You're capable of having fun. I am incapable of this emotion called fun. I'm not a fun man. Totally boring.
I just think that this fear of death comes from two places. One, you're afraid that you're going to lose shit that you haven't acquired yet. You're not even going to get to taste the life you've been working towards. Or two, you're afraid that death is coming because you have left yourself too wide open to think about it. You've given yourself all this time where you're doing fucking nothing, you haven't achieved any milestones in a while, and you're just letting your mind wander into those areas. The reality is that when you're dead, you're fucking dead, and it's inevitable, and it's gonna happen, and it is the great equalizer. So just have adventures now and don't live into your future. Just live for the moment, as cheesy as that fucking sounds.
That is really cheesy.
It is super cheesy, but it's true.
It's
you
some
don't
Taoist bullshit.
You don't think about death if you're having
fun. I'm gonna tell you what I'm gonna do. I've been thinking about this a long time. I really think I'm gonna fake my own death right before I think I'm gonna die. Because I wanna go to my own funeral, goddammit. I think it's bullshit you don't get to go.
That
Everybody should
shitty.
Be able to go to their funeral. I mean, think about it. All right? Just before you go, I would really love to see for myself all of those individuals that I've loved and have loved me and that I've had some influence over and so on and so forth. I mean, it's just like the only time of your life where you really are the center of attention and where everybody loves you and you can, you know, bask in that glory is usually people's wedding day. And by then, they're just stupid idiots who haven't done anything with their lives. Why can't it be right at the end? The fucking party. Like, I'm going to die soon. I want to have a big party. Pretend I'm dead. I'm going to lie in my casket if I need to. I just want to have my funeral when I'm around. And then after that, I can just fucking bite the ticket or just take a shitload of drugs and OD or whatever. Just, I hate the idea of not being able to my own funeral. That's what upsets me the most. That's the only thing. If I could be at my own funeral, that would be cool.
Yeah, I would totally agree. I mean, I just lost a friend last month and man, the funeral we had for her was epic. She was huge in the local burlesque scene, in the local volunteerism scene, in the local, you know, she did about billion zillion different things, and everybody from all of those scenes, and I mean freaking everybody, came out for both, for the reception, which was this huge all-night party thing, and then also for the funeral, which was about 2 days later. And I think if she could have been there, because she was depressed the last few months she was alive, because she lost her job, and there was this girl who was trying to, like, screw over on some shit, and she just kind of felt unloved, and I was like, man, if she could have come to that.
It's easy to lose perspective on that shit, isn't it? Easy to lose perspective. I mean, you don't get to experience it all in one shot, you know?
Yeah.
The only time you do is when you're dead. Talk about bullshit. We need to completely reimagine the way that we do funerals. Honestly, it's messed up. Totally messed up.
Well, funerals are more for the grieving anyway.
Yeah, I know they are, but damn it, I'm there. Well, at least my body's there. Why can't I have some fun at it? So I'm going to fake my own death. Probably figure I'm going to find some hobo that looks a little bit like me. Yada, yada, yada. He's in my casket, and everybody thinks that's me. But meanwhile, I will be disguised. And besides, if I say that now and then I do die, everybody's going to think like kind of Elvis style that I totally faked it and it's not me.
Brilliant.
There you go.
I get
and then
idea.
There must be a legend out there, the legend of the still walking good atheist.
That casket thing, that sounds hard. You know what you should do?
Cremation?
Because if you say that you donated your organs, then they have to cremate your remains. Right, and then you're this good guy who donated all his organs. Oh, such a great guy. Jacob was so giving. Someone's looking through his eyes.
Yeah, but that still means that I have to get that homeless guy to donate his organs.
Hmm.
Because then they can trace it.
Twice as many organs.
They got to trace it. Yours is more complicated.
Hmm.
I will be given my organs later as an anonymous John Doe that dies in some alley. OD'd.
I don't think you can give your organs if they don't know anything about you.
Maybe not. I don't know. I haven't really thought that far.
This is a really morbid, horrible conversation.
Let's move on. Here's something I wanted to talk about. Everybody, I can't tell you how many people emailed me with this, asking me to talk about this story because... I don't know. I guess it's really controversial. Basically, there was a study by an evolutionary psychologist by the name of Satoshi Kanazawa.
Nicely done.
Thank you. Who found a link between high IQ and atheism and liberalism. Now, number one, the study was done on teens. That's the most important thing to just keep in mind while we're going to be talking about this. And number two, the difference was about 6 points. 5 or 6 points in IQ. Now, before we talk about this, I think I want to just point out there to people who are always looking for proof that they are smarter than their religious counterparts. I'm like, do you really need a study to tell you this? Do you really need it? I mean, you probably just feel it. You're probably like, this religious conservative who is denying evolution is a motherfucking idiot. Do you need a study to tell you this?
Not only this, but this study is far inferior in so many ways to the one that Mensa did just like 2-3 years ago, which was, you know, better funded, had better statistics.
Fuck Mensa up the ass. They're just a club of people that have that scored well in a test.
You know,
be like, let's hang around
with
each other.
You know what Mensa really is?
It's a sausage fest.
It's a dating thing. It's so that smart men and smart women can find each other. It's nothing beyond that. Anyway, they have lots of cash. And they did a pretty good study, and they came up with the same thing. I just feel like this study was not well done.
Well, I think
I didn't want to talk about it. This is a poorly done study that says something we already all know.
The only thing that's really interesting about it is the fact that Kanazawa is actually an evolutionary psychologist. Now, I read his book, coincidentally, about a week before the study came out, called Why Beautiful People Leave More Daughters. And the book is kind of like, it's a bit of a pop
culture?
Not a pop culture. It's kind of like a... It's not something you want to take too seriously.
Right?
I
see.
For two reasons. Number one, they don't provide any particular statistics or proof of what they're saying. They're just putting it out there. It's almost like a Malcolm Gladwell book. You know what I mean? Like you're reading it. It's interesting. But at the end of the day, you got to take shit with a grain of salt sometimes. You know,
did you just diss Malcolm Gladwell's credibility?
I just a little bit.
I'm a little uncomfortable right now.
Why? What are you going to do? You going to smash me in the head with a vase?
I kind of love that guy.
Yeah, I know you love that guy, but let's move on from that one thing I just said.
There's a lot of credibility in what you're saying. You don't think so?
I'm just saying that when you're reading something and they don't necessarily provide, okay, well, where's that study that proves this? How might you be wrong?
Hmm.
You know, like in good science, you have to talk about, well, here is the theory, and here's how this theory might be complete bullshit, which is not something that everybody's always interested in doing, but a serious scientist is interested in this. And Malcolm Gladwell is not a scientist. He is a writer, okay? And he's not going to write anything boring about saying, I might be completely full of shit when I'm writing this. He's not going to write this. That's not a good book, all right? And journalists aren't always interested in necessarily the truth, because sometimes the truth is kind of boring. You know?
Okay.
Particularly with any scientific study that's done. The study has to be repeated again and again and again, and you'll find discrepancies, and you'll turn out that the study is complete garbage, and you got to throw it out. That's just how it is. It's laborious. It is boring, all right, if you're not totally interested in the geeky elements of science.
So what was this book about?
Oh, this book was, it was just about explaining what evolutionary psychology is all about. Because in terms of a popular science, it's relatively new in the scene. Although evolutionary psychology actually goes back to the 19th century. Charles Darwin actually did some of the first research on evolutionary psychology in The Descent of Man, and he also wrote a book about animal facial expressions.
Hmm.
And he was... if I can just for a moment geek out about Charles Darwin again for just 5 seconds, because the man was awesome. He didn't just invent the, you know, theory of evolution by the means of natural selection. It's also sexual selection that he talked about. And he invented fucking evolutionary psychology, trying to understand why is it that if organisms are, you know, participate in the war of nature, why would there be altruism? And he was explaining it back then as saying, well, maybe there's the fitness of the group is improved by, you know, altruism and so on and so forth. The man was brilliant. Brilliant, but nobody paid attention for the longest time to evolutionary psychology. It wasn't important. I mean, psychology kind of evolved as mostly you know, through Sigmund Freud and his ideas about the mind and the brain. And I think that for
what you want to have sex with your
with
mother,
with your father and your mother,
because I do, and I need to justify it. And my daughter and I are way too close. It's creepy.
What the book was trying to say is that if you want to try to understand human behavior, if you take this sort of like the classical psychologist viewpoint, which is to say, well, they believe, oh, the human mind is a blank slate and everything comes from your environment and so on and so forth. And they say, well, you know what? That's not true. They try to take an approach of 50-50, the nature and nurture, where they say half or perhaps even more of your behaviors are entirely the product of evolution. And if you understand our brain as sort of like the brain of a naked ape that lived for a very long time as a hunter-gatherer, then you can kind of piece together our behavior in this complex society by looking at how those behaviors might have developed under certain environments, certain circumstances. So that's what evolutionary psychology is about. Now, obviously, the critics are going to say, this is not good science. How are you supposed to test this? So on and so forth. But, like,
I'm not sure that psychology is ever qualified as good science,
right,
though.
Exactly.
Realistically?
No, you're right. I mean, that's why they always have big, gigantic fights, you know, scientists and people in social studies. They hate each other. It's been a long and horrible battle. With that said, though, I think what was really interesting about the book is that it offered some really interesting ideas that make you think. And I think that's the most important part of evolutionary psychology is that, you know, for some of the things that they say, for instance, I completely agree with, where they say, well, our ability for language is something that is innate and part of our brain structure and how it evolves because it's necessary. Evolutionarily, you need language. And in Steven Pinker's book that I keep talking about, The Language Instinct, he talks about that a lot as well, how we have a natural affinity for language and grammar and for the most part, you know, you just sit back and kids will learn your language. You don't need to teach them shit. They will hear you. They will understand. Bam. It just happens. And that makes sense in an evolutionary psychology kind of way. Rather than just say, oh, the mind is a blank slate and you have to teach a kid everything. And meanwhile, they have like no ability to learn. That doesn't make sense. You know, in our ancestral environment, that would not make any fucking sense that we would all be blank slates. So that's what the book is all about. One of the things that was really interesting about the book is that they were arguing that societies that are polygamous are more violent than societies that are monogamous. Their rationale for this was saying, well, look, if in a culture where there's polygamy, and I think he actually refers more to polygyny, I think is actually how it's pronounced, where it's one guy and many women.
Okay.
He says, well, if that's the case, there's going to be lots of males that don't get to breed. So as a result, you can expect males to be more violent in general because they have to fight over females, which is what you see in lots of other animals that are you know, polygamous. And if you take sort of Jared Diamond's in the third chimpanzee explanation, if you look at the size of our penises and the size of our testicles, that it's midway between the gorilla that has a very small testicle and doesn't breed a lot with different females, and the chimpanzee, which is a total whore of a monkey that fucks everything that moves, and that's disproportionately huge. Like if you were if it was the same proportion, my balls would be the size of a grapefruit. All right, in terms of the proportion of
Jesus.
Yeah, I know it's quite. They produce a lot of sperm. Hopefully, no one is eating when I'm saying this because it's disgusting. But we're in the
put
middle.
The fork down.
So we produce a lot of sperm, not as much as a chimpanzee, but much more than a gorilla. And the assumption here is that we're partly polygamous.
Mm-hmm.
So in that society, you have to be more violent. We expect men to be more violent. There's plenty of proof that men are, in fact, much more violent. And that monogamy actually makes a society more peaceful because now the men don't have to compete for mates. There's no need for you to be exceedingly violent or even murderous because you're going to be able to pass on your genes. And I think that he takes... And what's interesting about that is because he took some of those elements of that I was talking about in the book and he applies it to the study of saying, well, people that are more... altruistic and more intelligent are also likely to be more monogamous and less violent. And that's a very controversial thing to say if you really think about it, because it's like saying, well, any society that's polygamous is going to be a lot more violent. The other thing that was kind of interesting that as a corollary to this is he said, well, you can look at Islam as an example of why that might be true, and that although not every Islamic society is polygamous, that there, it has a long history of polygamy, and if you notice that the reward, say for suicide bombing, which is, you know, you lose all the potential for you to be able to breed and pass on your genes, but one of the supposed rewards is sex with 72 virgins. And if you're thinking about a male that has absolutely no access to any females while he's alive, because he has no status, he has no money, he's therefore not attractive to the opposite sex, this is your only recourse if you want to get laid. Blow yourself up. I thought that was actually kind of, it may not necessarily be true or the only reason why it happens, but it's pretty fucking interesting, which is why I recommend the book. But again, take it with a grain of salt, because some of the things they say doesn't really make much intuitive sense. Like they say in the book that taller men were more likely to survive wars.
Why?
They're not quite sure why, but one of the theories that they have is that when you're taller, the distribution of your organs are more spread out. So if you get hit by a bullet, it's less likely to hit a vital organ. Which, I mean, does it make sense, or might it just be a statistical anomaly that taller people end up surviving? That's the problem. You may not. It is very difficult for you to be able to separate what's a causation and a correlation. And this is kind of the weakness of evolutionary psychology when they try to make a claim and then prove that claim. Because there's plenty of ways that could be just a bogus statistical anomaly. Who knows?
Not only that, but it's I mean, is it taller or is it bigger? Because, I mean, I could see bigger warriors having a higher survival rate. I mean, is
no,
this
no, no,
all
no,
tall,
this is,
lanky
this is,
guys?
This
or?
Is tall, tall. No, this is not bigger. Just taller. In fact, I think if you were bigger, you're just a bigger target. Maybe if you're taller, you're harder to hit with a gun. I don't know. But this is one of the things that they were saying. They were also saying that people that are more attractive are more likely to have daughters. That's hence the title of the book. Because there's an evolutionary advantage for beautiful people to have daughters because the daughters themselves are going to be more attractive and are going to be chosen as mates and...
What
be
about,
more fruitful.
So guys don't need to be attractive? It's the less of
no, no, no,
narrative?
If both the father and the mother are attractive people, he says that there's a slightly higher chance for you to produce daughters than boys. And also, if you're smaller, you're going to produce more daughters than if you're much larger. So, I mean, it could be true, but I don't know. Hell, I don't know. There was really no... The appendix was kind of brief. It didn't provide a lot of study, a lot of evidence. And you know what? Kanazawa has been called on his shit before of saying, because he made a link between IQ and health. But he was looking at he was looking at Africa. And meanwhile, you're like, well, the lower IQ may not be anything inherent about their brain power. It's just that they're fucking poor and they have no access to any education. And if they have access to no education because they're poor, are they going to have access to health?
Okay, can we talk about a little bit about why this IQ study apparently got so much buzz? I mean, your fans were emailing you left, right, and center trying to say, hey, you got to put this up. You got to mention this. Why do we need to talk about this?
We just want proof that we're smarter. People like to be known because people like to be smart. All right. The smarter you are, you said this yourself, the smarter you are, the more you want to find out how relatively smart you are compared to everybody else.
That's not what I said. That's okay.
Well, that's what you told me.
That's based on this study about how... So people who think they know everything, part of the reason why they think they know everything and they don't is because the part of your brain that is good at remembering things, is good at processing information, is also the part of your brain that's good at processing information in relation to whether or not you are smart. So what they were saying in that study that I was telling you about was that if, when they tested for it, they would give everybody a kind of a this skill based or kind of IQ test, and then the people who ranked very low always said that they did much better than they did, and the people who ranked very high always assumed that they did a little bit worse than they did, but pretty dead on. But what they found really interesting was that when they told all of the subjects what the average was, the people who did really poorly on the study or on the test guessed that they did even better than they had guessed originally, even further away from what their actual mark was. And the people who did really well on it, once you gave them the average, they guessed almost exactly or very, very close to what they actually got on the test. Because people who are the part of your brain that's really good at remembering things and processing and stuff like that is also good at processing whether or not you're intelligent. And all
you
throughout,
just said that twice. Exactly
I know.
The same way.
But I'm just saying.
Just so that you forgot.
Okay, just so that. You know, I don't listen to this podcast when I'm doing the dishes. And you need to repeat things. You
yes,
repeat
ma'am.
Things all the time.
Yes, ma'am.
I think I'm becoming you. This is not good.
I love it.
Oh,
finish
well.
Your sentence, baby.
Yes. So. That wasn't so much about how if you're smart, you want to know that you're smarter. It's just if you are smart, you know, you tend to be better at kind of pinpointing where you stand in terms of the average.
Well, I think that, but what I gather out of that, too, is that there, you're going to have more of a curiosity to find out just how smart you really are. Because the people that were completely and utterly wrong about how intelligent they are, maybe part of the reason that they don't know they're stupid is they have absolutely no curiosity to find out how exactly stupid they are. Do stupid people know they're stupid? They don't care. They think they're probably smart, or at the very least, and I've heard this a lot from stupid people, is that they think they have a great potential for intelligence, but they're like, oh, well, I just don't apply myself. Which, is, I don't know, maybe that's an excuse for them. I have absolutely no fucking idea. But for the most part, if you are smart, you want to know, I think you want to know more about your relative degree of intelligence because... I mean, in a way, it might be more important to you. You're like, well, how smart am I? You know, it's like, how far can I push myself? Mm-hmm. How do I differentiate from the people around me? And I think to some degree, any time you can tell a person that based on what they believe or what they know or that they are somehow inherently smarter on average, I think it adds to this whole, you know, credibility that they have in their mind of saying, I am smart.
You know what, but we're all individuals. I mean, that study could say that you, all atheists, are the smartest ever, amazing, super, super smart, and then you could still be an asshole idiot. Like, it really means nothing about you as an individual. Just because the study came out, it does not change in any way at all how intelligent you are. The reality is that if you're a good free thinker, if you're open-minded, if you're a good critical thinker, you're good at processing things and thinking independently, which is the reason you've become an atheist, you're likely to be a little bit more intelligent and more interested in the world of science and have more access to the world of science because you don't have to feel ashamed about looking into it or researching it.
Or there's no active movement to repress information because that information may make you question God. I mean, in Ken Miller's book that I was talking about before, Finding Darwin's God, he talks about it. He was like some of his church buddies. He mentioned, "Oh, I'm studying evolution," and all of a sudden they were shocked. You know, he was a young man just reading the On the Origin of Species. It didn't make much of an impression on him at the time, but the thing that did make an impression on him was how scared everybody else was of that book. They're like, "Oh, you got to be careful with that book. You got to be careful." So I think that to some degree, when you are very religious, you do fear certain types of information. I mean, you may not actively admit that you don't read it because you're afraid of the answers, but you said it yourself. Everybody has doubts.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing you want to do is kind of open that out, you know, like that crack in the door any wider because you know where it might lead.
Well, the Taoists are specifically against knowledge because they feel like you are born with wisdom, and the more knowledge you ascertain, the more weakened your wisdom is.
What I mean, a load of goddamn
bullshit!
It's
so frustrating. I remember reading the Tao of Pooh and having all my friends were super into it at the time, and reading it and just kind of coming back and going, I don't agree. Not only do I not agree, but I am offended by the idea that knowledge is bad. Shut up.
That's a good point. Shut up, Pooh. You are not wise. You are just annoying. You're an annoying idiot, Pooh. Winnie the Pooh is an annoying idiot. That's
I kind of think he's cute. I like him. I used to read the stories with my...
Can you shut up your cat? He keeps
this
on meowing.
This is the first time he's ever been
He wants
meowed.
Attention. And he... You know what? I travel somewhere else. Completely different cat. Same fucking problem. It's like, hey, they're talking. Meow, meow, meow. I want to be part of the show. Meow, meow, meow. I just can't get cats to shut up around me. That's the problem.
I think it's because you talk incessantly and they kind of go, oh,
No,
I guess
I think
it's what we're doing now.
You know what it is? It's the slight vibration in my voice. Drives him crazy.
Huh.
Drives them crazy. It's like purring. See? He won't shut up now. You know what? We're going to end the show now. He totally threw me off. Anybody who's like, hey, this is going to be a long show. Bam! The show has ended. The cat fucked
I'm
me up.
Sorry.
The show is over.
I'll lock him in the bathroom next time.
And if you're interested in that, if you any of you guys have emailed me about that study, if you want to read more on evolutionary psychology, read Why Attractive People Leave More, Why Beautiful People Leave More Daughters. I think just in terms of kind of seeing a different approach to human psychology, it's an interesting little book. And fuck, I read it in one night. Okay, it you can go through it pretty easily. It is not that
big of a deal.
Sounds
like my kind of book.
Well. You like short books? You hate books that take a long time to read? Come on now. What's wrong with you?
I just, I like easy reads. I like when things are spelled out for me a little bit. If it's really complex, I feel overwhelmed.
Well, I mean, I'm that way too sometimes. I guess it depends on the author. All right. Anyways, before we go, I'd like to remind everybody, if you're a fan of the show, you love what we do have a bonus podcast for you guys. We're now at episode bonus show 44. So if you become a member now for $20 a year, you will gain access to all the backlog of those shows, plus shows for the next year. So that's one show a week for the next year, unless it's one of those weird weeks where I take time off. It happens sometimes. You can't get 52
You're so
shows a
lazy.
Year. Maybe you'll get 50 or 48. It'll still be a lot. Trust me. I'm just trying to be honest here. 52 weeks of the year, I'm not going to work. All right? Sometimes I'm going to take some time off. It happens. You guys have, you regular 9-to-5ers, you get vacation. I like vacation too. I know I don't work that hard, but I still like some vacation from talking.
I sleep till noon and I work. I do a few podcasts. I need a vacation.
Well, if they want the crack, then they have to pay for the crack. Luckily, the crack is really, really cheap. That's the
sure.
whole. That's the whole thing about. I don't charge a lot because
drug.
I don't charge a lot because I know that it's not really worth that much. But it's worth at least a little bit. Okay, with that, my name is Jacob Vorjak,
and I'm Carissa Hendricks.
Have a good atheist day, everybody.